This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network with another recording of a local public event. I'm Dan Daniels. On July 31st, 2006, the Thomas Jefferson Area Community Criminal Justice Board and Central Virginia Restorative Justice sponsored the seminar Restorative Practices, Achieving Safe, Healthy, and Respectful Schools. The guest speaker was Mr. Joseph Roy. Mr. Roy is the principal at Springfield Township High School, just outside Philadelphia. Schools are the centers of education, yet all too often violence and disrespect interrupt student learning and teacher instruction. This seminar suggests the development of a restorative, collaborative, constructive, and accountable culture in our schools, without draining resources or compromising instructional time. Mr. Roy highlighted the strategies undertaken in Springfield Township High School, which integrated restorative practices in 2001 and 2002. This is the first part of a two-part podcast. In part one, we'll hear Mr. Roy's comments on restorative practices. In part two, we'll listen to questions and answers from the attendees. And now, here's Joseph Roy.
Let me say a little bit about myself. I am the principal of Springfield Township High School, which is in what we call an inner ring suburb of Philadelphia. We border Philadelphia. And we are a suburban district with a pretty strong urban flair because a lot of our students and residents move over from Philadelphia into Springfield. Seems like the trend is because the Philadelphia system has a lot of challenges. Maybe stay for grades K to 8 in Philadelphia in public or parochial schools and then try to move elsewhere for high school. So our district is, it's a small district, but increasingly diverse over the last 5 to 8 years in particular, becoming much more diverse rapidly for a district that had traditionally been pretty much lily white to now be at a 25% minority student population over the last few years. Really has been a change. And so we've tried to be as proactive as possible. I've been at Springfield for 6.5 years, so we've tried to be as proactive as possible to make sure we're engaging all students. So we have a changing community right now, and it's restorative practices a large role in our work there. Prior to that, I was principal at Palisades High School, which is in a more rural area, Bucks County, about 45 minutes from where I am currently, and that had beautiful upper Bucks County is more rural. And prior to that, I was an assistant principal in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And if you know Bethlehem Steel, except it doesn't exist anymore, and so you can imagine what happens to a city when, you know, an industry that employed 40,000 people disappears over a period of 15, 20 years. So Bethlehem is on the comeback for sure, but it's a gritty town of about 70,000 people, big high school, 2,600 kids at the high school. Population was a changing population there as well, with an increasing Latino population, with a lot of kids coming from Puerto Rico by way of New York City. So I've had several different experiences in different settings that have helped shape my beliefs and what I think I know and what I think works in schools. So I wanted to share that a little bit with you. I also was really happy to see that there's a cross-section of people here this morning from schools, from community groups. I know I saw some uniformed police officers here, I guess school resource officers who play such an important role. And I think that restorative practices can connect with everybody. We have a couple of security officers. They're not school resource officers. They're retired Philadelphia police officers, and they came into the police department in the heyday of Mayor Rizzo, which, if you know anything about Philadelphia history, was the law and order days, the crack 'em in the head days. And so when these guys came in as our security officers, they weren't that interested in the notion of restorative practices at first. But they knew that it was a different setting. They weren't on the street in Philadelphia anymore. They were in our school, and they've now become a couple of our greatest proponents in how to work through issues with students. And their, I guess, change of heart and their embracing has really had an impact because they're all over the building all day long. They're interacting with more students than possibly anyone in the building. So I share those things by way of background for you. My title, The Transforming School Culture Through Restorative Practices, I really want to emphasize that I see restorative practices as a piece, a critical piece of improving schools, but not the only piece. And everybody, I know there are a lot of school administrators here, we know there's so many things that go into making a school work and improving a school, but I think that restorative practices can play a key role in changing the school culture to one that is more positive, positive relationships, people working together. I should also say that you'll be able to determine the slides that I made, which will be text with bullets, versus the slides that my daughter made for me when I was when she helped me do the PowerPoint. So anything that is beyond the basic, I give credit to my daughter. The metaphorical school. I want to start by thinking broadly about where schools are today and then use that as an argument and a rationale for why restorative practices are needed, and then talk about what exactly are restorative practices. So we think about the metaphorical school. Traditionally, schools are, and you know, I'm going to speak in general, so if your school doesn't fit into this at all, please don't take offense. But in general, traditionally schools have been, you know, they're fairly bureaucratic. We have set schedules. Teachers do their work behind closed doors. Teachers work individually with students, in classes of students. Not a lot of time for teachers to work together. And we have, in larger public schools at least, often, you know, we're moving kids through on a set schedule from one grade to the next or from one period to the next. And the result of that is that people are isolated. Teachers will tell you all the time that they feel isolated from their colleagues. It doesn't contribute to building positive relationships. Add on top of that, that the traditional method of punishment or discipline, is a better word, in schools is punitive, in that the student does something wrong, we give them a consequence, send them on their way. That too does not encourage positive relationships where people can work together and we can have kids learn from their mistakes. And I think one of the problems has been over the last 20 years there's been tons of initiatives to improve schools. Going back to probably, I guess, a Nation at Risk report in the 80s, there's been one effort after another. But a lot of those efforts have focused on what I consider structural things, not cultural things. When we think about the school culture, I'm really thinking about the relationships and the values that go with that. But a lot of the changes have really been structural. So you think of that the school is built on a foundation of the culture is the foundation of the school, the people, the values, the relationships. And the way I view it is our foundation has been getting weak and cracking over time because we haven't paid enough attention to cultural issues because we've done structural things like block scheduling, which we have at my school. Is block scheduling or intensive scheduling big in the South? Is that? It's everywhere now, I guess. We have block scheduling, but that's a structural change. We changed the number of minutes in a class, and the cultural foundation continues. We've tried different things with groupings and tracking and detracking, but we haven't touched the culture of the school, and it continues to crack. We did try cooperative learning. This has some of the examples of things. That, too, cooperative learning, at least, I could see, started to work towards some relationships with kids working together, but it was still at kind of the technical, structural level of instruction. And my argument is that as we've done all these structural changes, we haven't paid attention to culture of school and the relationships, student alienation, and so forth, that we've just weakened the foundation. And then finally, the results of that is that the school building comes down. Clearly, that was done by my daughter. So culture change, you know, what do we mean by that? I have a definition that I pulled from some source, and we can read that, and really you read it, and it's like, what does that really mean? It has every possible word that could be associated with culture. So for me, the way I look at it is this. We need to address the academic side and the affective side. that personal relationships piece, the emotional piece. And we're more comfortable, I think, in schools dealing with the academic, because that's really what we've been trained in. We know curriculum, we know content, we know pedagogy. But when we look on the, so that's what, you go to what your comfort level is. And then on the affective side, we have not paid enough attention to that. And you're not going to have successful schools if you only pay attention to the academic side, at least in today's world. So I look at it as, when we talk about culture change, moving from relationships that are based on authority and blame to relationships that are based on trust and support. That's kind of the philosophical value change that I think needs to happen. We talk about culture really moving to a collaborative culture with positive relationships, increased safety, and increased academic performance. A lot of times we think that if we're paying so much attention to the affective side, that somehow that's not going to help us on the academic side. But people who have been in the classroom know that you have to deal with both. When students come in with social, emotional baggage issues, if that's in the front of their head, they're not going to learn what you're teaching that day. So I believe we can move away from the isolated, traditional, individualized culture of schools to a more collaborative cultures, focus on positive relationships, will result in positive relationships, increased safety, and increased academic performance. And I think that now with the pressure of No Child Left Behind, and I'm sure Virginia has state achievement tests, right? I guess everybody has to now. We certainly feel the pressure with the Pennsylvania assessment tests of academic performance. And so the tendency is to go in that direction and focus. You need to focus on the academic piece, but if you ignore the affective piece, you're not going to get there because kids are not going to be able to learn or perform. So it brings me to why change now? Why is now, I think, a ripe time for restorative practices? There's competition in education and societal forces I'll posit as the two main areas. In competition in education, there's a lot more pressure on schools, a lot more competition. We hear from the business, and I'm sure you do, from the business communities. We need students with technical skills, math skills, reading skills, but we also need students who can work well together and have all of those people skills as well. So there's pressure on schools from the marketplace. There's pressure on schools around school choice, vouchers, even the No Child Left Behind encourages if a school isn't doing well, kids can leave to go to other schools and so forth. So there's pressure on schools there. Global communications and global communications and information. I think of it this way. Like, what do we have to add as the school? What's our value added? I think our value added is the social piece and the affective piece that we can really help students learn to work together and how to get along as a community. Because think about it, in the past, if you wanted to learn chemistry, you had to go to school to learn chemistry. The one set of encyclopedias that you had on your shelf at home wasn't going to cover it. Now, you can pretty much go online and learn and find the information on for whatever you want to learn, chemistry, biology, whatever it is. You can tap into the world's museums and the world's greatest universities and libraries. And so I worry about if we're not bringing something that kids can't get sitting in front of their computer at home, then we're going to start the public schools, my main focus, are going to lose even more support. And I think, again, relationships, the affective piece, the social piece, the community building piece that restorative practice helps with is a key piece. That's our value added. That's what we do special. And then also education standards through No Child Left Behind puts a lot of pressure on schools as well to change. So we feel a lot of pressure. On the societal forces, slide I made, on the societal forces, I just listed a few of them, and most people in here are working in schools or in community agencies, and you know the issues as well or better than I do. That these issues that get in the way of students, we can pretend they come in ready to learn, but if they're dealing with issues of alienation and drugs and alcohol, violence, family stress, so forth, that gets in the way. And restorative practices helps helps us find a way to deal with some of these things. And changing demographics, I did some looking on websites, at least for the cities, Charlottesville City Schools, and I see there's an emphasis on the achievement gap and issues of equity, as there are certainly in my school district as well, that those provide put forces on the public schools. So when I think about changing culture, so my answer to these issues is move towards more collaborative culture, and then my tool to getting to the collaborative culture, one tool, is restorative practices. So I think of collaborative culture as the three R's, the other three R's, of relationships, relevance, and responsibility. And I think, talk about relationships, that people are communicating with each other, listening to each other, treating people well. Responsibility, personal responsibility, responsibility to yourself, as well as responsibility to others. And then relevance, I think of more in terms of the curriculum and making it relevant to students. So at least for restorative practices, we can focus on the relationships piece and the responsibility piece. I think that when we talk about restorative practices, it's all about responsibility and it's all about relationships, so that students learn to take responsibility and also make sure that they're fixing relationships that they damage when they have misbehavior. That's kind of why we need to move to restorative practices. We know that there are lots of obstacles that get in our way to changing the culture. Lack of time, mandates from above, lack of consensus, avoidance of real discussions, power of the status quo, inertia. Those are just quick ones off the top of my head. We know, if we've worked in school, it's hard to change things. And you're talking about changing culture. You're talking about how people relate to each other and treat each other and work together. Very difficult proposition. All of these obstacles are there. My suggestion is you start small and you just start working one step at a time. Just a couple of thoughts on each. The avoidance of real discussions. We are, I think, all, you know, my experience is totally in schools, but I'm guessing it's not that different elsewhere. We are really good at avoiding the real issue and talking about what makes us comfortable. And one quick example of that, my school did a diversity survey of students, a perception survey that we worked with a consulting group and involved community members and parents to design. And the results, it was a great survey, worked with a professor from a local university to make sure it was well designed and so forth. And we got the results back. I was all excited that we had, you know, good data on student perceptions. And it showed us things that we shouldn't have been surprised at, and that is our minority kids had less positive perceptions of staff than the majority kids and less positive perceptions of classroom climate. So it pointed a direction of work for us. And we shared the results with the faculty. And this is getting to the avoidance of real discussions. And I wanted the faculty to dig into, here we go, here's the data, our students' perceptions. This is what our students are telling us. And the conversation was almost exclusively about the wording of the questions. Well, if we would have, you have a sometimes response. If we didn't have a sometimes response, then we would have forced the kids to make a choice. And, well, this isn't clear. And it was all about, and I was so frustrated. And my one assistant principal said to me, you know, what was going on there? They were talking about everything but the real issue, because it's hard to talk about the real issue. And I think that in moving towards a collaborative culture and moving towards restorative practices, as you'll see, in a minute when we get into more detail about restorative practices, avoiding the real discussions is a big obstacle. Where people, one of the people I've worked with a lot in restorative practices, one of the big gurus, uses the term, you know, let's get real. Well, easier said than done in a lot of situations. So these obstacles are there. There's no easy magic solution to get over them. But starting step by step is one way to do that. I think that restorative practices provides a conceptual framework. It's not a program. I guess you've heard, you know, like there are programs out there, assertive discipline or positive discipline, or there are reward programs. The kids, you know, do what they're supposed to do. You give them a sticker or a piece of candy or something. And, you know, things work for different people. But this is not, I don't view it, it's not a program. It's a conceptual framework for how to approach relationships. So here's the philosophical conceptual piece of restorative practices. Use the term social control window. On the vertical axis, we have control. Also, I probably more often say limit setting or expectations. Because I think this can apply to a lot of different interactions. And if it's expectations for student performance, it can apply to a lot of things. So on the vertical axis, you have control, limit setting, expectations from low to high. On the horizontal axis, support, again, from low to high, supporting students when they have issues and helping them learn and grow from their experiences. So in the upper left quadrant, we're going to divide it into quadrants. The upper left quadrant, the punitive box, where you have high control and low support. Punitive. And the parentheses word there is to, that we're doing something to the student. Probably, this is where, I wouldn't even say probably, this is where most schools fall in dealing with discipline. We're in the punitive model, where the kid does something, we assign a consequence, and we move on. I think of my work, and it was mentioned in the video there, when I was an assistant principal, I was really good at suspending people, and I could do it. I could really do a lot of suspensions in a short period of time because I had to, because the discipline referrals were coming in so quickly. There were so many incidents and so many serious incidents that I could barely keep up with it. So I had to get the kid in. This is what happened. What's your story? Whether I heard the story or not, suspension out the door, send the paperwork on the way, get the next kid. Thousands of suspensions. That's the punitive model. Or the students creating a problem in a class, so the teacher assigns the detention. Come after school. Now, if the kid comes after school and the teacher sits and engages them in a conversation about what's going on, that's a good thing, I would argue. But if they just come and sit in the back of the room and do something while the teacher's doing paperwork and there's no dialogue, that's not a good thing. That's in the punitive box. And I learned quickly as an assistant principal that I thought, you know, you get the referral, you read what happened, you're ready to roll with the consequence. But I realized that life is in the gray area. So I'd read what the teacher wrote, and then I'd hear from the kid, and a lot of times I'd be like, wow, this just, you know, things don't make sense. There's something in the gray area here, and I wasn't clear exactly what was going on, but a lot of times I had to support the teacher. I wanted to support the teacher, and so I whacked the kid anyway, even if I had some reservations about it, because that was our system. And that happened over and over. And what happened to the kids? Well, they got, if a student doesn't really buy that he did anything wrong in the first place, and we're not really taking the time to help him understand how he did affect others, then he thinks he's the victim. He's the one that did something inappropriate, and he's the one getting the detention or the suspension, but he leaves my office thinking he's been mistreated. And so he's more alienated, he's the victim, he's more anger. Yeah, he does his 3 days suspension, which probably actually isn't that bad for him, because he gets a couple days off, and then he comes back, and nothing really has changed. And he goes back in the same classroom with the same teacher, except this time, now he's a little more aggravated with the situation. So this is where most schools fall, and I think it's because a lot of it is time. Like, it does take more time up front to have more conversation and try to help the student understand what's going on. I'm going to show you a continuum of restorative interventions that you can see from quick to longer. But time is an issue. And tradition. I know when I get a referral from a teacher from a classroom, they didn't write the referral if they're, you know, a good teacher. They didn't write the referral the first time the kid sneezed. They're at their limit. They tried to deal with it. Now they're ticked off. So when they write the referral, they want action. And action traditionally is detention, suspension, something along those lines. And if you don't do it, then the teachers are concerned that you're not supporting them. So the whole system reinforces this punitive approach that is really hard to break out of. But if you're in a situation where you have lots of rules, and Lord knows schools have lots of rules and lots of guidelines and policies and regulations, but not a lot of support in the notion of helping students to learn from their mistakes, then we're in the punitive box. That's where most of us are, and that's the hard part to break out of. The next quadrant, the lower left quadrant, where we have low support and low control or limit setting or expectations. This is what we call the neglectful box. If you're in this box, and sometimes, honestly, I feel that schools don't often go into this because we always have lots of limits. But if you have a situation where we certainly think when we're frustrated with a family situation that we might think the parents are being neglectful. But if you're in a situation where there's not a lot of limits being put on the kid, or if you're in a school where you're not really enforcing the rules that you have, and I've been a principal for a building administrator for 14 years. I am really big on if we have it as a rule, we have to enforce it. If we're not going to enforce it, let's not have it. Because as soon as you set an expectation or a limit and then ignore it, you're starting to slip into the neglectful box. And then if you're not holding kids accountable and setting limits and you're not supporting them, you're just neglecting them. And again, for me, the best image of this is some of the family situations I've seen where the kids can, you know, come and go at all hours of the day or night, and the parents aren't setting limits, and they're really not doing a lot to help the student as well. There could be situations in individual classrooms, classroom management with a teacher who is not good at setting limits and is not particularly supportive either, and the kids are just kind of gliding through in a poorly managed classroom. I can guarantee there's not a lot of learning going on in that setting. Move over to the lower right, and this is the permissive box. Are there any guidance counselors in here? All right, so I'll be careful what I say here. No. Sometimes the truly helping people, like I say, there's no crying in my office. Go down to guidance if you have to cry. But for the people that actually are a little more empathetic than that, that sometimes we have to be careful. We want to help the kids so much. We don't want the student to fail. And we feel badly if they come from a tough situation. We know what's going on at home. We know what's going on in their neighborhood. And so we want to support them. And we're going to do everything we can to bend over backwards to support. But if we're not setting limits for letting them get away with things, then that's the enabling behavior. And sometimes we fall into this box. And then I like the word, the parentheses there, for, where we're doing it for them. So I can think of examples where, you know, the student's having a problem with a teacher, so the counselor or the social worker, you know, will go speak to the teacher on their behalf and try to make the student's case, and doing it for them rather than getting everybody together and having a dialogue about it. So the permissive box is done with the best of intentions, but we got to be careful not to slide into that because we're not setting limits. And we know, you worked in schools at any time, or you're a parent, kids need limits. Kids want limits. And then you have to make sure, as the adult, you're holding them to those limits, or else you slip down to the neglectful or permissive box. So I didn't say anything good about these three boxes. Luckily, in the fourth box, there's something positive to be said. And when I have shared this with parents, it like clicks automatically with parents. And you think of your role, for those of you who are parents. You want to have control. You want to set limits, have good, high expectations for your kids, but you obviously want to be loving and supportive. And when we have both high control, high limit setting, and high support, we're in the box of doing it with the student or with the child, as opposed to two or four or not doing it at all. So I guess often the question that comes to mind then is, why the word restorative? How does that apply? And this is how I think of it. When we're talking about wrongdoing in school or in the community, somebody's done something wrong. Committed a crime, or in a class they've been extremely disrespectful, whatever it is. Often we look at the rule, and this was certainly my principal role, look at the rule, they broke it, this is what they're getting, this is the consequence. And I didn't pay a lot of attention to thinking about, you know what, when he said this to that teacher, that was pretty upsetting to the teacher as well. And yeah, the teacher might feel good that he got suspended for 3 days, but they're going to go back in that classroom. They're going to have to work together. Hopefully the student's going to learn. We haven't done anything to really deal with the underlying issue. And that's where the restoring. What are you going to do to restore the relationship? You've done damage. You've done harm. Restore the relationship. So restorative practices, you view everything through the lens of relationships. So, yes, the kid was disruptive in class, and he broke the disruptive rule. But he also damaged his relationship with the teacher by doing that. And he affected the class, and he affected the teacher. He took the assistant principal's time, whatever it may be, that he now needs to restore. He needs to fix what he did, what the problem that he created. And a lot of times, and I'll show some talk about some examples in a minute, but it can be really quick. Like if I'm walking around the halls and I see a student sitting outside a classroom, it's usually not a good sign. And so I'll just very quickly say, what's going on? Oh, and usually, of course, I didn't do anything. The teacher sent me out. And I'm not going to get into the whole thing in the middle of the hallway, but I'll just say, well, you know what? You're going to have to go back in there at some point, either today or tomorrow, and you're going to be in there the rest of the year, so you're going to have to figure out how you're going to fix it with the teacher. How do you think you're going to fix it? And they know I need to apologize. Okay, good. Make sure when you go in there you apologize. You don't have to make a big deal about it, but just do a quick apology. And then I go on my way. I even had to use that one day. Both my daughters go to my high school, walking around, and one of my daughters is sitting in the hallway outside of social studies class, praying, she told me, that I wouldn't walk by. Unfortunately, I did. But same thing. You know, what are you going to, you know, I'm not going to, you know, intervene unless the teacher wants me to. I'm just walking. But I'm still going to reinforce that message to the student. How are you going to fix this problem? In our school, if a student gets sent out of class, and I should say that, you know, I view the classrooms as each class is its own community. And we know this, that, you know, your period one class can be totally different from your period two class, just in disposition, makeup, and so forth as a teacher. And so each class has its own personality, its own climate. And there are times, and when you build a community, if someone does something that is offensive to the community, it's appropriate for them to be removed from the room. So, and that's kind of a point of it. Your behavior now, you need to be out of this community for a period of time until we can figure out, and you can figure out what you're going to do to fix it so that you can come back into the classroom community. So when kids get sent out of class at our school, we have an in-school suspension room, and they immediately get a piece of paper with a series of questions on them. And they have to, that are designed to get them to reflect on what happened and think about how they're going to fix it. And a lot of times, the first pass on those questions, especially if the student is angry that they got sent out, is not, you know, good. What needs to be done to fix this problem? Fire the teacher. We say, no, that's not the correct answer. Do it again. Because they know, you just have to get them to say it. They know what the right answer is. And we've had times where students have, you know, been very adamant about, they're not accepting any responsibility. They're not doing anything. And then they can stay in school suspension for a while. Maybe they'll go to their other classes, but the next day they're not going back into the class where they had the problem until they're prepared to fix the problem that they caused in that classroom community. We joke, we're just going to keep them on ice for a while. And it doesn't usually take very long for the student to decide that, you know, they want to get out of the in-school suspension room. And we also use our guidance counselors to help them come to that realization. So as far as when I say conceptual framework, this is what I'm talking about. We want to think in terms of setting limits and being supportive. You think about new teachers a lot of times. We really emphasize this with our new teachers. New teachers want to be liked. They became teachers because they love school themselves, and they want to be popular with the kids, and they want to have a good relationships. And the most common mistake of new teachers is to set limits and then not stick to them, because they don't want to be viewed as a bad guy. So they'll go over classroom rules at the beginning, and then they'll forget about them. And then we have the issue of how do you get that back, which is not easy, once you've stopped enforcing the limits. So we talk, you know, as a conceptual framework for teachers, limit setting, but support. So you hold the kid accountable, but you let them know that you care, and you want to fix the problem, you want them to fix the problem, you want it to get better. You're not just punishing them and throwing them to the side. It's about this point in sometimes when I present, when some people in the audience are thinking, you know, all this, if we're going to talk about it and have the kid, you know, think about that somehow, and I get this from teachers as well, that if it's not the traditional punitive, if we're not in that punitive box, if there's going to be some type of discussion and helping the kid realize what he did wrong, that somehow it must not be tough enough. Somehow it must be touchy-feely if we're not in the punitive box. So for those people, I wanted to do another slide that says, restorative practices, it is not excuse-making. We're not interested when we do a little conference with the student on all of their excuses. We're interested in the accepting consequences and how are you going to fix it. And that's our most common terminology. Okay, what are you going to do to fix it? We still suspend. This is not like an either-or proposition. I need to make that clear as well. This is not like someone, you know, curses out a teacher, and so you get together and talk about it, and the kid understands he offended people, and that's it. I believe, you know, it's not either or. So we certainly, when the offense warrants it, have detentions and suspensions. And if the student commits I'm a firm believer that if you commit a crime in school, it's the same as committing a crime out on the street. We're calling the police. And so we can involve the police, we can have a suspension, but we can still deal with it restoratively by having the follow-up conference, by having the meeting where we help the student understand and work through, and ultimately, okay, you got a suspension, that wasn't fixing the problem, that was just a consequence that happened to you, what are you going to do to fix it now? So it's not an either-or proposition that I wanted to make clear there. Restorative practices give you true accountability for behavior. Because when I was just suspending somebody and they were leaving more angry at the school, they weren't accepting accountability. They were just getting suspended. And that was my fault. It was the school's fault, and they're ticked off at me now. There was no acceptance of responsibility. So we got to get off of that notion that, you know, by punishing someone with a suspension, that's the kid's taking accountability. Not true at all. Prisons are full of people that are being punished, but who are innocent, who accept no responsibility for what happened. So that's not the same thing. Punishing and accepting consequence, accepting responsibility, not the same thing. There's a series of restorative questions that we use with students in conversation, in the conferences. Teachers will use them. We have them do it. I didn't even realize this was timed. It's coming up by itself. That's tremendous. If we look at the questions as they come up, and hopefully it'll stop there. First off, what happened? And that's important. I guess I'll start with that, because that's the first question. Notice the question that's not up there is why, which is often our first urge. Like, why would you do that? Why in the world would you do that? Or what were you thinking? They probably have no clue what they were thinking. And if they were really thinking, they probably wouldn't have done it. So one of the learnings for me back a number of years now when I was first engaging restorative practices was this notion of, I'm not asking why. I'm going to stay focused on, you know, what happened. How were you involved? What was your part in it? Because that leaves open the possibility that other people had parts too. So we're not totally laying blame on, you know, we're leaving the door open. What happened? What was your part in it? How were you affected? who else was affected, or how were others affected? And then, what are you going to do to fix it? Now, when you're working with a student, depending on the issue and their resistance level, you know, you have to work through these things. You know, how were you affected? Well, I wasn't affected. Well, think about that again. You're sitting in the principal's office or assistant principal's office, so, you know, there must have been some effect on you. Who else was affected? I don't know. Well, if you did know, who do you think might have been affected? Or can you take a guess? Or if I got your friend down here and asked them, they were in the class, who do you think they would tell me was affected? Who do you think the teacher thinks was affected? You can try to get it. The point is to get them to realize that other people are affected. And if you really want to do it, and it's an issue that now the parent's going to be called, the parent has to come into school, leave work, go late to work, whatever, the list of people that are affected by relatively small discipline issues is much more than the kid thinks. But that's the first step. Who did you affect? And then once we get that identified, then we're going to start to think about what needs to happen to make it right. What are you going to do to fix it? And, you know, in a lot of times in school, it's an apology and a promise and an agreement to not do it again, or a plan to talk about how are you going to avoid not having that happen again. How do we need to help have other people help you do that? But the point, the restorative questions, really critical. We're not asking why. I've also run into issues of if a student says, I'll apologize, and then they apologize, and the teacher says, I don't think it was sincere. I say, I cannot look into the student's heart and judge the degree of sincerity. If they say the words, I'm sorry, especially kids who are oppositional and defiant, if they can come into your return to you and say, I apologize for what happened yesterday, you got to take that at face value. Don't start, you know, rejecting it because you don't think it was sincere enough. Take it for what it was. So the focus here is on the impact of your own behavior on others, which is what kids don't get a lot of times. That's part of being an adolescent. They're like totally focused on themselves. I always am reminded of that if we put pictures up in school, pictures of the homecoming dance or whatever, people flock to the bulletin boards to see the pictures of themselves. It's all in MySpace now? What a perfect adolescent thing, MySpace. It's all about me. Kids are focused on themselves, and it's our job to help get them off of that a little bit and think about other people that they might be affecting. Sometimes completely not, they're not on purpose pretending they don't know who they affected. They don't know because they haven't been able to look past themselves in a while. So the restorative questions get us into the mode of having kids start to think about it. And this can quickly, and it might take longer in a more serious issue. But at least in the what we've found, in the normal amount of time for an assistant principal to call someone down, here's what the teacher said, what's going on, kid makes all their excuses, you can, instead of going through that routine, you can go through these questions and come up with, in the same amount of time, and come up with a better solution. Okay, what does it look like in schools? This is what we call the restorative practices continuum. I'm waiting to see if these are coming up by themselves. I guess not. I'm going to start on the informal side, and what I'd like to do is give you some examples of each of these so maybe you can picture what it looks like in school. So affective statements. Affective statements, for people who are counselors, this might ring true as I statements. This is what I would example at the classroom level, that what you say to the student, subtle changes, just like I'm not asking why, I'm asking what happened. Subtle changes that can lead you to having kids be more reflective about their behavior and take more responsibility. So an affective statement is just, you know, a quick letting the student know that what they did had an impact on you. Whether, you know, hey, and this would be just like, you know, teachers pull a kid out into the hallway for a quick one-on-one if something's going on in the classroom. Same thing. You're just going to try to think about what you're saying a little differently. So instead of getting them out in the hallway and saying, you know, why did you do that? What were you thinking? If you do that again, this is going to happen. Don't ever do that. We're going to say, you know, when you did that, I was really upset. I was really angry. I was frustrated. I was whatever, because I'm trying to, you know, get this lesson accomplished. And I know we have, you know, midterm exams coming up, and I want my students to do well. And it's frustrating you know, what can you do to, you know, help avoid that situation, help me avoid that situation, and put it back on the student in that way. Sometimes I, when working with teachers, classrooms are about authority, and teachers need to be the authority. Even in a collaborative classroom, teachers are the authority. And some teachers are hesitant. Well, if I make an affective statement, I'm letting the kid know they got to me. And you don't want to let them know they got to you. And my response to that is, when you're yelling at them, when you lose your temper and you yell, you're showing your emotions and you're letting them know they got to you, but you're doing it in an out-of-control way. Why not do it in a more in-control, strategic way, where you're working them rather than them pressing your buttons until you scream? And so the affective statement is just a quick, and the purpose is simple. And this isn't to solve the problems of the world. This is for, you know, low-level things in the classroom, we just want to, by consistently doing it, letting kids know your behavior is affecting somebody, and this is how it's affecting me. The next step then would be using affective questions, which I already went over, where, again, I'm going to look at the teacher doing the quick questioning of students to try to resolve what was going on and look for how the student's going to fix it. I have an example on the affective statements. I had a young teacher once who her class was in the habit of, I think they were ninth graders, maybe 10th. Every time she would say, "This is what we're going to do today," some number of kids in the class would do, "Oh, that's stupid," or, "Oh, that's boring." Or so it was just like every time. And she's, you know, excited. She worked hard with her plan. She comes in, says, "Hey, da-da-da, this is what we're going to do today." "Oh, that's stupid." And it would just like knock the wind out of her every day. So when we were talking about it, I said, "Well, have you told the kids that it knocks the wind out of you every day and that you work?" So she went in and said to her teachers, to her kids, "You know, when that happened, you know, I work really hard to have the best lessons I can so that it's exciting for you and you're involved. And when you do that, it hurts me. It just knocks me down because the kids heard that. Things got better. A few weeks later, we had a transfer student come into her class, and one day, starting activity, and this transfer student says, "Oh, that's stupid." And a couple kids near that transfer student look at them and say, "Don't say that. She works hard in these lessons." And she knew that, you know, it made sense. So it's, you know, kids want to see if they don't see you as a human being and someone that they can have a connection with, you're going to have more conflict. When they can see you as a human being and have respect for you, they're going to watch out for you. And that was a great example of the affective statements. Affective questions, I mentioned. Impromptu conferences. I would consider this to be we can define these however we want, but I'm kind of moving from very informal to more formal. This is kind of in the middle, where maybe the teacher's been having a problem with a couple of kids, and he or she's going to pull those kids together, and they're going to have a little conference in just a few people and the teacher. A lot of times our informal conferences are impromptu conferences are with the assistant principal. There's an ongoing issue that the teacher hasn't been able to resolve, and there's been contact with the parent and so forth. We'll have the assistant principal sit with the student and the teacher. And we'll prep the teacher ahead of time. You know, here's our game plan. What do we want to get out of this? And, you know, make a game plan. Have the student come in and then basically run through the restorative questions about what's going on, what's your role in it, and so forth. The danger for the teacher is that we're going to ask the student what's going on. So they may say things the teacher doesn't want to hear about, "Well, everybody in this class is talking," so forth. So for the assistant principal's job is to keep it focused and not let it become a blame the teacher game. That's what usually happens when you just do it without the teacher. And you want to keep it focused on a problem-solving mode. So what are we going to do to fix this? And then the teacher can say, you know, and we even ask the student, you know, "What do you need? You don't want to be getting kicked out of class every day and getting suspended and having this issue and having your parent be angry at you and everything. What do you need?" And then the teacher will say, "Here's what I need from you. I need you to be on task, da-da-da-da, whatever." And then there's an agreement, and the student then talks about this is what I'm going to do to try to fix the problem. What we have found is, again, that takes more time, because if you're an assistant principal and you're a busy day, I have a referral, I want to grab Johnny right now and deal with him, but the teacher has a class right now, I can't. So it takes a little more coordinating on the assistant principal's part to, you're going to see the student when the teacher's available, but our experience is if you do that and fix it, then you're not going to see Johnny four more times from the same class, and in the long run, you have actually saved yourself time. And that has been the case, getting people to sit down and problem solve and have the students figure out, this is what I'm going to do to avoid this problem in the future with the teacher and the assistant principal, has been extremely effective for us. So that would be an impromptu conference. Again, a little more time up front for an assistant principal, but saves time in the long run. A large group. This would I would consider to be a class. And I'm say a little bit about, you saw in the video kids sitting in circles as circle check-ins in classrooms. I want to say a couple things about that. But for a large group, for a class check-in or a class circle, and some of these ideas I think already happen a lot at elementary schools. They'll like do class meetings, so come in from the playground, have a class meeting. Kids can talk about, you know, who pushed whom and so forth. But it's the same idea, is that you want to create an atmosphere in the class where students can talk about what's going on and problem solve together. I have a couple examples here, one of which I can't read, so give me a second. We're going to skip the first one because I can't read my handwriting. But we will encourage teachers to run circles in their own classrooms. And again, I want to get into more detail on that. But if you've never done it and now you have a discipline issue and now you're doing it, it's not going to work very well. We will have our assistant principal go into classes. That's our least favorite option because we don't want to take away the authority of the teacher. But if the class is at the point where it's not functioning very well, classroom management-wise, and the teacher agrees and feels like, yeah, I need the assistant principal to come in and run a circle to try to get the issues on the table and come up with a plan of action for improving everything, then we'll do that. And my assistant principals are very good at doing that and coming out with positive. And what that basically does is, instead of it's, you know, the teacher dealing with a handful of kids, because most of the kids in the class are probably annoyed with the handful that are continuing causing problems and tensions. But so if everyone has a say in how we're going to make things better. And sometimes, there was a little example, I think, in the video when a student said, you know, I did this, next time I won't do it. But the best part is when people start to talk about how they'll help each other. Well, if I see that Johnny's getting tense or having a bad day, I'll, you know, say something to the teacher and, you know, he can take a walk, or I'll go over and, you know, calm him down. And so the idea is through these class meetings to start to have people look to take care of each other. I just read my writing. Now I remember the first one. And I'm glad I did, because it's the most powerful example I have of effective restorative practices. We have a 11th grade English and social studies teachers work together in a class we call American Studies, and it's really for lower level students who are alienated and not the most positive about school. And they've been teaching this class for a few years, and they use restorative circles to build community in their classes. And one year, a couple of years ago, the one teacher made a comment that was taken as a racist comment by some students in the class. And I don't recall what it was, but at any rate, a handful of kids in the class were really upset about it, really angry at the teacher. And the two teachers who were co-teaching tried to deal with it, but the anger was just there. So then one day they're outside of their classroom as kids are coming in, and these are juniors. Two seniors that they had the year before come to them and say, "We heard what's going on. We heard that people are, you know, mad because da, da, da. Let us go in and run a circle." So they stand out in the hallway. There was a teacher aide in the classroom, just in case. And they went in. So you have these two seniors. And again, these aren't our model students. Of course, they were cutting their class they were supposed to be in to come do this. But nonetheless, it was for the greater good. They come in, they get the class in a circle, they get the issues on the table, and these guys are saying, look, we were with Mr. So-and-so for a whole year. He said it. You know, if he said it, that's not who he is. And so they come out and they say to the teachers, okay, I think they're ready for you, but you need to be ready to listen when you go in. Teachers go in, they hear their thing, they work it out, they move on. But again, kids knowing how to take care of each other and develop the responsibility was a great example that these kids had heard it on their own, come down to help solve the problem. Move on to formal comment. I'm going to come back to the large group as a check-in when we talk about classroom check-ins. So a formal conference then is where I would say not a classroom setting. This is how we've used it at least. But there's been some act of wrongdoing in the school. A big fight, graffiti, vandalism, something like that. And so the formal conference, and if you do any reading on restorative conferencing, there's a very formal approach where you involve all the people who were affected. So obviously you're going to have the students, if there's a victim, you have the victim, you're going to have the parents, if there's police involved, everybody who's been involved, who's been affected, and you run through the circle in a very structured manner where you ask each person, what happened? How were you affected? How were you affected? How were you affected? How were you affected? While the offender sits and listens. So we make sure he gets it. We've used, and because formal conferences are definitely time-consuming, we much more are in the informal, quick, getting the student and the couple of people who were involved together. But for a couple of serious incidents that we had... Well, example from this year, we had a new student to the school who was quite an artist, but he liked to do his art on the bathroom stalls. We have security cameras in our school, not in the bathrooms, but in the hallways, so it's pretty, we can pretty quickly, narrow down who was in and out of the bathrooms. And we were able to identify the student who did it. And he was a young kid, ninth grader, new to our school, came from a much rougher school, and he just didn't get that that's not what goes on here. And so in this case, we decided because he was new and young, new to the school, that we did not call the police. Typically we would on graffiti, and it cleaned off real easily. But we decided to do a formal conference in a little bit of a different way. We got two older students who we were trying to, again, not model citizens, but, they had the potential to be role models. We brought the students in. So our conference consisted of those two students who we wanted to role model for the younger student, and they had been transfer students from Philadelphia as well. And we had the custodian who had to clean it. We had the security officers who had to do the investigation and take their time to track it down, the assistant principal, myself. And then we ran our circle. The most powerful part of all was not what, we said, but the student, he sat and heard how each of us was affected. He needed to understand that it pulled the custodian from his other busy duties to go to the other end of the building on a couple of occasions when he did it to get this scrubbed down. He needed to understand the time that it took on the assistant principal's part to investigate. But the most powerful part was what he heard from the other students when they're telling him, why look around the building? Why would you do that? We don't have that here. People don't do that here. And then they gave him some pats on the back. Look, we know you take care of your little sister after school every day. We respect you for that. But, anytime you need anything, you come, you can talk to us. You see us around. And so forth. And the kid heard the message from other students that that's not what we do here. And then our question to him is, what are you going to do to fix it? The graffiti was already cleaned off, but his proposal was that he do some cleaning around the building to fix what he had done wrong, to assist the custodians. His idea was to do a little bit of the custodian's job to make up for the fact that he had created more of a job for the custodian. And that student, you know, is on track the rest of last year. This is early in the year. And I believe it's because we could have just suspended him, and we could have called the police and had him charged, and done the traditional punitive approach. Then I would have had a new student, a young student who's going to be with us for a while, who was going to be angry at the school and angry at everybody in it, and we were going to have more issues down the road. By dealing with it the way we did, I have no concern whatsoever that he'll repeat that graffiti. And we know that he had a good rest of the year looking at his discipline record. So the formal conferences take a little more planning because you have to prep everybody. Like, we didn't just get those older kids in and say, you know, we prepped them on what was going on and what we wanted from them. We've also used formal in another case of vandalism. We used it in a case of, when I was first there, there were some, pseudo gangs. They weren't real gangs, but they wanted to pretend they were. And there was a big fight in the parking lot. And they were suspended. I suspended everybody involved for as long as I could because I was really ticked off. But then we also ran conferences with parents, police, and so forth to try to reduce the tensions and also have the kids take some responsibility for what happened with that. So the formal conferences are not common occurrences. It's much easier to do the quick with a few people to solve the issues. So that's kind of the restorative practices continuum. When we first started working in schools, in my schools on this issue, we would talk about all of this stuff, and we would do the social control window, and then we were often left with, okay, now when I'm a teacher and I go back in the classroom, what exactly am I going to do? And so we were looking for something, a concrete way to build relationships and to establish more of a restorative environment. So that's when we began to focus on running circles. And classroom circles are a critical piece, we've concluded, to building the environment, the community in a classroom where people look out for each other. So you can do, let me just give a wide range of examples, because the first thing that comes up from teachers is, oh my God, how am I going to have time to do this? I don't have time to get through the Algebra 2 curriculum. How am I going to do this? And our response to that is, you know, if you do the things up front to build relationships, you'll recoup that time by not having to deal with discipline issues down the road. Or if you do have a discipline issue, you'll be able to deal with it pretty quickly and get back on track. So what we tell our teachers, you know, it depends on your style and your personality. I believe that good teachers, people who have excellent relationships with kids and are positive and set limits and provide support, they're naturally restorative. They're restorative before we ever use these words, but what we've done for them and for us is provide a common vocabulary. So now we can all talk the same language and we can use the same questions with students. So for those teachers who have very positive class communities where kids are working together and collaboratively, you know, they may do a circle once a week, just check in on Monday, what's going on, this is what we're going to be doing this week, that's fine. Some people do it a couple times a week, check in at the beginning, check out at the end. Some people do it closer to daily, depending on the students that they have. But here's the idea, is that the class sits in a circle facing each other, not in straight rows where you're looking at somebody's back, and you talk to each other about whatever it is the teacher chooses. Another piece that I get from teachers is concern, well, I'm not a counselor, I'm not running a group therapy session. No, it's not that. It's simply a way for people to communicate. So we tell our teachers, start with academic issues. You know, you're going to do a circle, just go around and do a check-in on homework. Who had problems with the homework? You can go around and ask, if they're doing a project, have everyone report out, here's where I am in the project. You could do it at the end of a class and just have everyone, you know, say, here's what I learned from today's lesson, or here are the questions I have. But the idea is that we're sitting in a circle facing each other, talking. Then you can move to, if there is an issue, a lot of teachers do it on Monday just as a quick check-in. You know, everything go okay, how are you coming into school, the beginning of the week, and so forth. But if you have that habit, of meeting as a classroom group and circle, then when you have a problem, you're in a better place to solve it. So if it then, let's say, a couple of kids begin to be a problem in the class, and now the teacher has a mechanism to get everyone in a circle and say, look, we all know this has been going on. These two, you know, Johnny and Billy have been, you know, disruptive for the last week, and, you know, it's upsetting to me, it's distracting from the class, we need to figure out what we're going to do about it. And so it's not just the teacher telling the kids, it's the whole class with those two kids solving the problem. When a student gets thrown out of class, we make them go back in, and in a circle, they have to apologize to the class for disrupting it. That's the worst punishment. That is way worse than any detention. When you have to go in, take responsibility, and apologize to your classmates. But then we try to look for how can we work together to solve problems. So if there is an issue, student is always late to class, a low-level annoyance in our school. And so we could have, if that's a constant problem, maybe somebody else who walks from the same, has the same previous class says, I'll walk with him, you know, I'll walk with you to make sure you get there on time. So you start to look for ways that the kids are being responsible for each other and to each other. That's when you really know that you're making progress. I've seen it in art classes in an academic sense where, in art class kids are often working individually on projects and some people be farther ahead than others. And by doing a quick check-in, and you find out that, you know, Billy is just starting this project and doesn't know how to, you know, do whatever. And Susie did it last week. So the teacher could say, hey, Susie, can you touch base with him for a couple minutes to make sure he knows how to do it? And you just foster that idea of looking out after each other and working together to solve issues. The most powerful example that I witnessed of the power of circles is we have I mentioned our 11th grade program with kids who are not that into school. We similarly have a 10th grade program, and we have it where the two classrooms are right next to each other on either side of end of a hallway. And at the end of a period, there was a fight in the one classroom where a transfer student and English as a second language student was fed up because apparently people were giving him a hard time. And he went after another student in the class. And the way that 10th grade program is set up, there's three teachers are involved. So the kids in the program are spread between three teachers, let's say period one. Fight happens at the end of period one. So now everybody comes out, and you know what happens when there's a fight. Everybody is worked up. Everybody's got to hear about it. It gets exaggerated. It's just the hugest deal. And so now, and I happened to be there because I was going to be observing the one teacher the next period. And so now you have the kids from the two other classes coming in. And again, these are not our best behaviors overall. And the other kids are, you know, everybody wants to know about the fight. In a typical situation, that's going to take a while for the teacher to get people settled down. And then, of course, if there are threats of follow-up and his friends are going to do this and that, it could go on for a long time and really detract from the academics. But in this situation, because the kids, they use circles, the teacher in the other class quickly caught on that something was going on, and she said, you know, it sounds like we need a circle. Let's get in a circle so we can talk about it. So within seconds, they're in a circle. I joined it since I was there to observe anyway. And very quickly, the teacher went, you know, what happened? Well, the kids knew darn well what was happening, that this student who went after the other student was getting picked on. And so instead of focusing on the glory of the fight, they quickly focused on what was the problem. Gee, someone was getting picked on, and then what are we going to do to fix it? Because he's going to be back in this class. He's going to get suspended because he went after somebody and was fighting, but he's going to be back. And when he comes back, what are we going to do to solve it? So they focus on very, very quick. This did not last more than 10 minutes, a quick focus on what are we going to do when he comes back? Well, we'll do this. We're not going to pick on him. Somebody will welcome him back, help him get caught up on his assignments and so forth. And they moved on. Then they were ready to get into the academics immediately. Totally focused, totally calm. And it went from what could have been just the big scene for the rest of the day to a problem that was handled in a matter of minutes because they were used to talking in circles like that. It wasn't something new. If the teacher had never done that before and came into running a circle, it wouldn't have worked because they wouldn't have known the purpose of the circle. So time is an issue for teachers. There's no doubt about it. and circles in classes that challenges convincing teachers that it's preventative. It's relationship building. Kids will learn more when there are positive relationships, when there's a collaborative culture, when kids are working with the teacher and not against them. And the time that you invest in some quick circles comes back, again, I think, many times over in solid academic time and academic learning. So just reviewing what I had mentioned before, again, thinking of relationships, relevance, responsibility, the restorative practices framework really lays out for us an approach to building the relationships and ensuring the responsibility. I wanted to say a quick word on equity issues and restorative practices. When I first was working with restorative practices, really I started focusing on the discipline issues. I was at Palisades, and we had Palisades Academy. It was a school within a school where we were trying to really do project-based, a team of teachers working with a team of disenfranchised students to really do school differently for those kids. And the teachers worked incredibly hard to create a project-based, individualized curriculum. We planned it for a couple of years. We sectioned off a part of the building. We redid rooms. We got it right, except that we totally focused on the academic side and the structural side, and we didn't pay enough attention to the affective. So when school started, the teachers were doing it differently and working incredibly hard, but the students, their same old behaviors that they learned over 10 years, I think these were 10th graders, they didn't change at all. And the teachers were incredibly frustrated by the defiance and the lack of motivation and cooperation. They were doing it differently, but the kids weren't. And the teachers were about ready to shoot me for talking them into doing this. So we started worked with restorative practices in Palisades, and we quickly were able to build positive relationships in that academy, and within a matter of weeks, by changing some approaches and how we interacted with the students, those students were on board and they became the greatest advocates for the academy program. But I realized then it was about relationships, and we hadn't paid attention to the students' habits in relationships in school. And then sometimes those kids would be great in the academy for half the day, and then they'd walk out to go to an elective, they'd immediately get in trouble because they didn't have the same relationship with other teachers or with other people in the school. So that brings me to the idea of equity. At Springfield, we started, as I said, our demographics have become much more diverse over the last number of years, and it's an issue that we're very passionate about getting right and being proactive and making sure all of our students and parents feel involved. And we've done a lot of things with teacher trainings. I mentioned the diversity survey we did. We have an equity plan to implement a lot of activities. We're going to, institute, because this is new to Springfield, institute a mentoring program and more academic supports for all students and so forth. We did a lot of structural things again. And we had a meeting at the end of this with parents of minority students, kind of as a reporting out. We had done a town meeting a couple years ago. This was kind of a reporting out. Here's where we are. And the message I got from the parents, where we were ready, all the teachers who are working on this, report out, here's all the things we're going to do, all the actions. The parents basically were like, nice, but I'm concerned about this happened between my child and a teacher, and this happened between my child and a teacher, and I heard about this. They were totally focused on relationships, which I don't blame them as a parent. So again, we need to do these other programs we're doing to support students, but it just reminded me again, this was at the end of May, that from the parents' perspective and the students' perspective, it's all about relationships, feeling that you're respected, you're valued, and the person, the teacher cares about you. And so we've done much more. So I approached restorative practices more from discipline, classroom management. And now I'm seeing it over the course of the last year as an absolutely critical tool in our equity efforts, equity and diversity efforts. I believe that one key to closing achievement gaps is the relationship piece. Absolutely essential. Everybody needs to have opportunities for high-level instruction and to be challenged. But the relationship piece, so people take advantage of those opportunities, has to be there. And so we have refocused ourselves, and we looked at where are most of our minority students. We have three levels of classes, honors and academic and what we call level one, which is for students who are below grade level in reading. And the majority of our students, our minority students, are in academic college prep classes because of some work that we've done in focusing on where our kids. So we're now taking that core group of teachers in English, science, social studies, math, and a couple of elective teachers who are really motivated, because teachers, those teachers who teach the bulk of our academic level sections have the bulk of our, they're our most diverse classes. That's where the kids are. And so we wanted, if our survey told us students feel, minority students have less positive perceptions of classroom climate and staff, it was in those classes where we could make a difference. So we are doing second level circle training. Some of the teachers are new, so it's new to them. That'll be coming in. But we're refocusing and retraining again on circles, because I really believe that circles, circle training and circles in the classroom, that is the way to build the relationships and to build the foundation for restorative practices. You set your expectations, but you provide a lot of support through the circles. And it's not just the teacher providing the support, it's the whole class providing the support for each other. So restorative practices has now migrated as in our school from broadening beyond discipline and really looking at this is now a huge piece of our diversity and our equity work, because it's the key to building positive relationships. There are many obstacles, and I actually didn't list them here because there are so many different obstacles that we could list. But certainly, as I mentioned earlier, it's hard to change the status quo. It's hard to change what people expect. Teacher expectations of what discipline should look like. It's hard to change interactions. It's hard to change the culture and the relationships. But if you focus step by step on training teachers and set it as something that a goal that we're going to pursue, then you can start to change your culture. So my final thoughts before we get to questions are: getting started, start small. Identify key teachers that would be interested and motivated. We know the model of, you know, you always have your initiators and your high flyers who will try anything that you want, and they're always the innovators. And you have the large group of people in the middle who are good people and will come along, but they just need a little more convincing, a little more, they need to see it work. And then you have the people, hopefully, the smaller percentage of people that, you know, are negative about any change. We call the initiators the eagles. The people in the middle are the prairie dogs. Because you know how, if you picture like a prairie dog poking their head up out of the ground and looking around? So they're poking their head up, looking at a new initiative, and if they see somebody get whacked because it doesn't work, they're down and forget it. You're not going to see them for a long time. But if they see it okay, they'll start to come out a little bit. And then we call the dinosaurs, which aren't going to do anything new, and you're just waiting for them to become extinct. Or encouraging them to retire or whatever it may be. But it's the prairie. You want to start with the eagles, and maybe pull a prairie dog or two in there. But you want to, anytime you're doing something new, you want to set it up for success. That's something I've learned. I didn't always figure that one out. But you want to do it don't start too large, start in a way that you find initial success. And then once you have success, then you start picking out those prairie dogs that you can pull over in the next round. And so you start with, so what I suggest is you do an overall with the whole faculty. Here's what we're talking about. Maybe an hour, hour and a half. Here's what we're talking about. And then you do real training and circle training with a seed group. And then the next year you do the next group, the next year you do the next group, and you expand it over time. It can't happen without the principal's leadership. And I'm biased towards, building level leadership as the key to any success and changes in schools. I know we need the district offices or the county offices for some things. I'm just not sure what. I'm a building principal, but I know that if the building leaders don't embrace something and really want it to happen, there's no way it's going to happen. In my own district, our middle school, which is literally, 100 feet away from us, is the principal there gave lip service. We did some training with teachers. Just never happened. Now we have a new principal there who's interested, and I'm very excited about getting restorative practices really going at the middle school. And middle schools, with their team, at least the way our middle school is set up, with middle school teams and advisory periods and so forth, are perfectly suited for circles and for restorative practices. So start small, find the right people to get started with, and then expand from there. But you have to have the focus, and you can't give up when you run into resistance. So thank you very much.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Daniels.